Today's guest is my prequel to the autumn release of Series 7 of my podcast, Events That Made Me. When I first contacted her and got an immediate response, digested her way of communicating, I knew she was a fellow Pisces, and I was right. The four events that she shared have intrigued me. This is my scoop. Please welcome the brilliant genius that is Sam McAllister.
What an entrance, Liz. Thank you so much. I owe you 10 quid.
Only 10, you cheapskate.
Total cheapskate.
I'm so thrilled to have you on because I just think the story is fascinating. And I know that the listeners will too. And every guest sends me four things that make them turn right or left in life. And yours were quite personal. So let's go to the first, which was the top of your list. And you say that your first challenge was coming from a different background. Why so?
I think I'd never really realised that was a thing because I spent my first years of life in blissful ignorance of things like class and prejudice, those kinds of things. But when I hit 18, 19 and I went to university for the first time, I started being asked all these questions that had never appeared in my former life, like, which school did you go to? Where exactly are you from? What do your parents do? All these kinds of monikers of identity that had meant nothing to me. And I realized very quickly that in this new world, I was seen as coming from a different background because my parents both left school at 14. My mum was brought up on a council estate. We were market people and, you know, cockneys, basically, all living in the East End, ducking and diving. And I'd never known any of these questions or any of these expectations or, frankly, any of these judgments. So it was the first time I started to get a taste of the very important things that other people were thinking about that had been completely irrelevant until that point for me, but became incredibly relevant, unfortunately, for the rest of my life and career.
Was going to university a natural progression for you, or was this a big thing because you came from a working class background?
I mean, by the time I went to university, my mum and dad had been very lucky and they'd made a bit of money. They were entrepreneurs. They'd left poverty behind. But as you say, neither of them had been to uni. No one in my family had. So it was like a really big deal. So when we kind of like got to the stage of going to uni, you know, we're very nonchalant about it for those of us who all come from that background. But my mum and I like basically visited every possible place. You know, they must have thought we were a bit mad. We'd turn up, we'd kind of like go and have a look around because my mum had never been either. So it was not a foregone conclusion. And when I started to do really well academically, my parents were next level excited and thrilled, but there was no expectation to go. And there was no judgment if I didn't, but my parents supported me 100% and were absolutely thrilled when I decided to go and continue education because they'd never got that chance.
Well, not only did you continue education, but you studied law. And I wrote a book in lockdown, but my father was a judge, so I was brought up with it. My background was different to yours in that mine was very privileged, but unhappy. And yours obviously was a very happy upbringing. I wanted to be a barrister, but circumstances were such that I left school at 18 and I didn't do it. Why did you decide not to practice?
I think you've hit on something really important there, Liz, in your question, though, which is that the greatest privilege is happiness and a family that support you and love you unconditionally. And I had that. I had it in reams. And I really think the thing I've learned over this entire period of my life is that I never took that for granted, but I did not realize how rare it was. In truth, I did practice. I practiced for 2 years. So I went to the bar as a baby barrister and I wasn't quite as naive as I was when I turned up to university. I'd been through, you know, basically 4 or 5 years of being perceived a certain way. So I wasn't quite as naive as I was at that time. But it was a pretty brutal environment, to be honest. I was a fish out of water. I was the only person wearing trousers. I was the only person who spoke the way that I spoke. I was the only person who kind of like seemed to care so much about the clients I was working with. And probably the only one who didn't see them as different to me. It was just I'd had some twists of fate. So I did it for 2 years, but I was miserable as sin, and I'd been taught to chase happiness. So I decided to leave that behind, and it was the best decision I ever made. And my parents were wanting me to be happy, so I didn't get any judgment or any problems or any hassle from them. They just said, look, darling, if you're miserable, as I was, leave. And so I did.
So it's a massive change, jump, to go from being at Grey's Inn to being a producer on Newsnight. Tell me how you got there.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, Liz, I kind of went home, you know, the day that I stopped being a barrister with no plan. And I was on my sofa and I thought, geez, I have, you know, 35 or 40 years nowadays, maybe 50 years left of working life. And I don't know what I'm going to do. I just had to walk away from the unhappiness. So by then I'd learned that networking was very important. I hadn't met a lawyer until I became one. So I was unused to having networks. But I had some friends by this stage who did some interesting jobs. And I asked one who was working at the BBC if I could pop in and spend some time. Now, lo and behold, first of all, they let me. Probably very anti-meritocratic, but what can you do? You have to do what you have to do. And second of all, she was working on this Radio 4 programme called Law in Action, which was a magazine programme on once a week about legal issues. And they had no lawyers on the team. So when I went in, everyone thinks when you do the law, it's like everything. So I was able to assist in a way perhaps that was more elevated than some of the people on the team. They gave me, you know, 6 weeks, and I ended up staying for 16 years, 10 of those at Newsnight.
Did you love it?
I loved so much about it. And as you may have noticed, if I love something, I stay. And when I don't, I leave. So I loved it for a long time. And when I stopped loving it, I left.
How old were you when you left?
I was 48. So, I mean, I've just basically done so many careers now, it's almost embarrassing. But I think one of the great things about coming from a different background where there isn't this expectation is it gives you an audacious fearlessness. There is no such thing as failure. So I've been relentlessly optimistic that I'll just keep trying new things. Now, that might be foolhardy or it might be fabulous. And thus far, I've been hugely lucky. But I walked away from a stable job at the BBC because I wanted to write a book about my experiences in booking this incredible interview with Prince Andrew that obviously became a huge deal journalistically and internationally. And that wasn't a viable option at the BBC. It was made clear to me that that wasn't a go. So I threw the dice, Liz. You know, am I going to sit in the shadows and wait for something to happen? Or am I going to take a huge risk? By now, my son was much older. I'm a single parent. So it's a single income household. So the risk is big. But I threw the dice, took a chance on myself and walked away to write a book. I'd never written one before. And I was given 3 months to put together 80,000 words. So, you know, it was a big risk and it was extremely intense, but so far so good.
My mantra is you can never fail, you can only ever learn. And I gave a lecture the other day at the university to 240 students, all sat there, you know, living in hope that they've got a future in event management. We had a great afternoon talking about being an entrepreneur, and I said to them, I said, you never fail, you can only ever learn. We're coming on to Scoop in a minute because you are my scoop, obviously, today. I'm intrigued by the whole thing. What I'm picking up from the conversation is that you're probably dead nosy, actually, and you're very intrigued by stuff. And I think that has contributed hugely to the success because you've been digging, and you wrote the book. And I mean, for me, that's key. Let's go back because the fourth event that you gave me, no, the third event that you gave me was being a single mother in the workplace. Was your son born out of wedlock? Was it unexpected?
No, I was happily married at the time, but then unhappily married. So as ever, if it's not working, you've got to say goodbye. But being a single parent in a workplace, I think is very tricky because being a parent is already tricky because obviously, you know, there are certain things that you have to kind of walk away for. And if I were someone without a child, I could imagine that sometimes I would be pretty annoyed at some of the concessions that are given to parents. Now, add into that that I was a single parent with no plan B, no other adult in the household. So if things went wrong, it's me. There's no one else. So you are really imposing sometimes, frankly, on some of your other workers and other colleagues to basically pick up the slack when you have to go because there's a hospital involved or your kid throws up and you have to go and collect them. There is no nanny. There's no husband. There's no au pair. Sometimes my mum could help, but not always. So I think it creates a different dynamic. In a sense, I never felt guilty for it. It was just my natural circumstance. But I did have to basically organise my life like I was running the UN, except for more successfully. And there was nothing that could go wrong. Not one minute could shift. Otherwise, everything would just, you know, fail. I just spent every day rushing. You know, you rush to the nursery. You know, you can't bear to leave your child, but you have to. You rush to the workplace. You've already done 3 hours by the time you get to the office. And then all day, you're, you know, clock watching to the rush to get back to the nursery or to get to your mum because she needs to get home or whatever it is. So you're just in a constant state of pure rush. And so it's only been when I've left the BBC and started this new life that I really realised that I just spent, you know, 15 years just literally pacing it without stopping. And it's wonderful to stop.
It's wonderful to stop. I also think that I brought two children up on my own. I did have a nanny. And I, for the first 5 years of starting the business, I paid the nanny. I took nothing out for myself. But it shaped the children. And they are far more independent and self-sufficient than I think that they would have been. And I actually look back with some pride at it and think, do you know what? I've juggled all balls here. Men can't do that. I hate to say it. And, you know, any men that are listening, they just can't do that. And I'm sure that your son has a huge amount of respect for you for the independence that you've given him. The fourth event, and now this is really why you're on here today, because I want to understand the story and the scoop. I want to understand how it evolved, what made you think of it. Just explain how it came about, because that's what intrigues me the most about you. There are many women that would have sat there thinking, actually, do you know what? I'm going to get Prince Andrew in a room and I'm going to get Emily Maitlis to interview him and tell his story and what a story it was.
Well, I mean, my job was basically, I was an interviews producer, which was the fancy title I gave to trying to get bums on seats at Newsnight. And at BBC Newsnight, you know, it was Jeremy Paxman when I arrived. And then latterly, before I left, it was Emily Maitlis, as you've mentioned. It's not really an intoxicating offer. You know, come on and be beaten about by a brilliant presenter who is going to have incredible producers who make sure that you have no place to hide in terms of accountability or any answer that you give. And Prince Andrew really wasn't on our radar, because at the stage at which I first started talking to the Palace, a year prior to this interview happening in 2018, he was kind of a forgotten prince. We hadn't really remembered his association with Jeffrey Epstein much. I knew about it because I was a barrister by trade and I'd always been interested in his friendship with him. But it wasn't top of the news agenda at all. And he was definitely bottom of the news agenda. So I was approached to do a piece with him about his entrepreneurial concerns, pitch at Palace. And we don't do that. It was what's known as a puff piece. You just go and he tells you how amazing he is, you know, and that's not really how Newsnight works. So we declined. I didn't even really mention it to the team. But I did say at the end of it, and I'm sure, Liz, that you're the same because you've been working in this world where contacts and connections are really everything, super polite. And I said, if things changed in the future and he wanted to do a more wide-ranging interview with Newsnight, you know, please do get back in touch. They never get back in touch, except this time. And so fast forward to May the next year, I get a message asking if I'm free on Monday to go to Buckingham Palace to meet Amanda Thirsk, who is Prince Andrew's chief of staff. She's played by Keely Hawes in the Netflix movie. And, well, of course I'm free. But in practical terms, it was actually half term. It was meant to be my day off. And so all the shenanigans of single parenting then, you know, go. My mum agrees to look after my lovely boy so I can go to the Palace. And I don't even tell my boss, because there is no way that Prince Andrew is going to agree to come on Newsnight. It seems so counterintuitive, against his interests. So I skip along to the palace on the bus, as was always my preferred mode of transport. And I just really made a day of it, to be honest. Obviously, I acted very professionally. I researched who I was speaking to. I had my negotiation points. I was going to put forward our reasons why he should speak to us in a proper, wide-ranging interview without conditions. But I didn't really think they would say yes. Now, that negotiation actually went really well, Liz. And it looked like, you know, I'd accidentally got an interview with Prince Andrew. That was in May, before things really hit the fan for him and for Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. But there was a red line, and his private secretary, Amanda Thirsk, said, by the way, you can't ask a thing about Jeffrey Epstein. That issue is closed. Now, we don't do red lines, but to be honest with you, at that stage, it probably would have been the last kind of like thorny question, because it wasn't the biggest story in town. But after that negotiation, it became the biggest story in the world. And Epstein's arrested, he's indicted, he's incarcerated, he's dead. Ghislaine Maxwell, she's arrested. She's about to be incarcerated. And the FBI are very interested in our friend Prince Andrew. So my non-starter puff piece becomes the biggest story in the world. And I've got a foot in the door. So as you can imagine, my editor is now gone from understandable indifference to extreme interest. And the pressure is really on me for months and months on end to try and reel in this impossible interview. And that's really effectively what I spent the next 6 months doing, culminating in that interview in November.
So where did the book come into it? Did you write the book for the film?
It goes the other way around. So usually you write the book and then you see if anyone's interested in what's known as optioning it. I was very lucky. I did a Channel 4 documentary that I managed to get going called The Problem Prince. And then Netflix were one of five people who were interested in working with me. So you create the intellectual property in the book. That's the key. Because obviously no one knew I existed. No one knew my tale. So I wrote the book in effect to say, oh, hello, you've never heard of me. My name's Sam. Here's what I did. And P.S., if anyone's interested in working with me, that would be great. But it could have been no one. As it happened, Netflix were very keen to work with me. And so the book happens first, then the documentary, and then the movie. So it's been a whirlwind. I mean, I didn't even leave 3 years ago, and I've had this incredible experience. I mean, I'm the luckiest woman alive.
I don't think that's right, actually. I think you're probably one of the cleverest, so I don't think you're necessarily the luckiest. I mean, I thought she was brilliant, Billy Piper. I thought she got you. I thought she was brilliant. I thought it was really good. Now you're in this whole movie scene and Oscars and red carpet, and you've just been in New York. And what's next?
Well, these were all kind of like offshoots, to be honest, Liz. My plan when I left was to, well, theoretically, work less. But that's not worked out for me. You know that as an entrepreneur. So I'm a CEO of a tiny thing, which is myself. But my plan was to do speaking, professional speaking. That was basically what pays the bills. And that's what I've continued doing throughout this entire period. And also I'm a visiting senior fellow at the London School of Economics. I teach negotiation there. So the plan still exists at the core. It's just that I've done these really crazy, snazzy offshoots, the book, the documentary, the movie. And obviously I intend to keep trying to do some snazzy offshoots, but my day-to-day happiness comes from doing speaking, corporate gigs, traveling the country, meeting loads of people. You said earlier about me being nosy, and that's probably true. But the truth is, I just love people. I am really fascinated. I love this country. I love meeting people from different backgrounds. I love to have a chat, have a natter with them, learn about them. And so the speaking really is like a fantastic way just to keep meeting new people in different areas and, you know, to pay the bills. I couldn't really enjoy anything more.
So, you know, you've had this huge success with the royal family. If there was one person that you could interview next, who would it be?
It'd have to be Putin. It's the biggest story in the world. So if I was still working in news, I definitely would be trying to get an interview with him. But I haven't worked in news for 3 years, you know, so I've left all of that behind.
So what's your plan for the future? You hustle. What's your plan? What you did and what you achieved was a one-off, and it was a world sensation. You can't just leave it there, Sam. What else are you going to do? You're not just going to stand and lecture and teach and do all that sort of stuff. There must be something up your sleeve that you would like to do.
Well, look, I'll probably write a second book. I didn't find that as arduous as other people seem to. So That's probably on the cards. I've got quite a few nice, generous, kind opportunities coming into my inbox that I'm exploring. So, you know, I'm receptive and open to trying new things. I think the thing that's really lucky about me is that I'm quite happy to try something that I've never done before. I mean, I have no journalistic training. I'd never written a book before. I'd never been an exec on a movie. I'd never been an associate producer on a documentary. I don't worry about trying new things. Just like you, I think trying stuff is a form of success, even if it doesn't quite work out. So I'm open and receptive to whatever the opportunities come, whether it's a podcast or a TV program, or whether it's another book, or whether it's something I haven't even thought of or conceived, because these things were things I hadn't thought of or conceived 5 years ago. So I'm just really open-minded about it, Liz. I just think it's so exciting, the opportunities that might come my way.
And what about your personal life? Did you meet somebody? Have you settled down? Or just... I'm being nosy now, Sam, very nosy.
You're welcome to be nosy, Liz. Nosy is what gets us into trouble and out of trouble, right? Nosy all the way. Oh, yeah, no, I don't think I've been single for longer than about 3 weeks since I was 16. So, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
I am with someone, yeah. He's even been in the papers with me. He gets papped in the back of my pictures quite sporadically. So he's the world's most papped sanctions lawyer. So, yeah, he works... He works at Latham and Watkins as a sanctions lawyer. So we've been together on and off for about 10 years.
Brilliant. Well, listen, first of all, thank you for joining me. I was intrigued. And what I loved was that I got you on Instagram and you replied immediately. And normally important people don't do that. So you're obviously not that important. And I'm very, very excited. Very, very excited.
Thanks, I think.
Very excited to see what you do next. You did say that you would join Ruth Langsford and I on International Women's Day next year. We had a great success this year, so I will remind you when the time comes round. But I, you know, write another book because I'm desperate to see what you come up with. And I wish you lots and lots of luck and thank you.
Oh, thank you, Liz. Well, I have definitely gone from Z-list to Y-list. So, you know, maybe by the time I see you, I'll be up to X-list.
If you've enjoyed this series of Events That Made Me, make sure you've given the podcast a 5-star rating wherever you're listening and follow me on Instagram at Liz Taylor Consultancy. Check out my website, liz-taylor-consulting.co.uk, and read the book, Tailor Made, available on Amazon.